On Southwest Boulevard, just west of Broadway, the artist's scribe has a three-walled mural right in the heart of the city on a concrete canvas that would haunt any graffiti artist's dreams. It's a three-walled enclave in an artsy yet industrial district, and he's filled the space with an ode to Kansas City that's been so popular it's even been used as the backdrop for a local hip-hop video. Against a black background, the words "Love Kansas City" pop. Big block letters are filled with brightly colored cartoon animal versions of local icons, Charlie Parker, Walt Disney, Harry Truman, and the Kansas City Scout. You know, the statue of an Indian on a horse with a bowed head overlooking downtown from Penn Valley Park. Walt Disney is blue, Harry Truman is kind of a greenish yellow, and the Scout is a pinkish red, which might, at least in part, explain what happened next. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And Scribe, what happened to your mural?
I think about a month and a half ago, after it happened on a first Friday. The next day, I got a social media alert that somebody had wrote a termination of Native culture on it. And so I had to rush down that morning and go to work on repairing it.
What went through your mind when you heard that those words in particular had been scrawled right where that Scout image is? And it's sort of the Scout near the Harry S. Truman. Is it like a Harry S. Truman bee?
Bird.
A bird, yeah.
It was originally a bird. You know, as I went down there, my first reaction was probably to take it as a personal attack. I've been lucky enough to go up to a place called Cheyenne River in South Dakota and work with the Cheyenne River Youth Project up there and do murals up there on a reservation. And so based off of the history that maybe only I know, I took it as an attack, you know, thinking, well, I have a small amount of connection to that culture. Why would I be accused of doing something wrong?
So when it said something about termination of Native culture, your thought was this is a critique of how I have represented Native Americans.
It can go several ways. I mean, since we don't, I have, you know, still shots and video footage of the people that did it. But you can't really get inside of their inside of their heads.
This is at Fox Equipment. So they have video surveillance of their parking lot, I'm guessing.
Yes, they do. But it wasn't until I got down there. I was upset when I went down there. When I got there, I was greeted by a lady who was genuinely shaken up and teared up when she saw it. And I realized that there were also people that really liked the mural. And it wasn't really until I was standing there and I started looking back and forth, because they had also wrote FDR and crossed it out. And so there was part of me that laughed, that was like, oh, you got the president wrong. And then another side of me stopped actually right there and finally, I guess, Google searched the question, what was Truman's relationship with the Native American culture?
Because those two characters, the Scout and Harry S. Truman, were very near each other.
They were right next to each other. And so when I was working on the mural, I was focused on design. I actually made the Native American character larger on purpose, because I felt like they were kind of treated as a minor character a lot. Same thing with Charlie Parker. It's kind of using, I guess, the hieroglyphics technique of like making some things larger and some things smaller.
To designate like importance, or just a sense of giving honor to those things
giving
that are bigger?
Giving honor and importance. They did it for both reasons. But it wasn't until I saw the FDR that I wanted to, I asked the question, because as I researched all of the different characters that are on there, you're presented with certain perspectives of history. And so that anger, I had to take a minute and step back and go like, why was this person upset? And is there a connection to the two?
It seems like you were trying to have a conversation with someone who wasn't available to you for like further information. You know what I mean? Someone was upset, because if the person had just scrawled like their own initials or something, okay, there's no message in that necessarily. But the words FDR crossed out and termination of Native culture seems like someone does have an argument to make, and you have to kind of piece together what it is.
Yes. And so that did make me step back. So when I first looked up Truman, you know, I've read up a lot on his, you know, wartime president and what he was challenged with and some of the, controversial choices that he had to make. But that was the only perspective that I was given. And on the Scout, when I did the research on the Scout, you know, other than personal opinions on the artist making depictions of Native American sculptures and stuff and whether he was the appropriate person to be doing that at the time, I thought it was really endearing that the people of Kansas City did like a nickels and dimes like collection and raised, I think it was 15,000, and it was the general public that actually purchased that artwork to be permanently displayed up there. And at least the way that it's listed online, it's listed as an honoring to the Sioux tribes of the area, and not as a mascot.
Do you have the sense, I mean, in your research, were you able to find out how Native communities view that sculpture today?
That was actually one of the big challenges when I started researching Kansas City history. I was really disappointed at actually how one-sided, and honestly, to put it blunt, it was white history. And so I had a really hard time finding specific things related to other people within the community. So I had to do a lot of digging. The people at Matty Rhodes were really nice to give me information on Primitivo Garcia. He was a young guy from Mexico that put himself in harm's way and was killed near Westport High School defending a white teacher.
When was that?
I think it was 30 years ago. I think that we're on the anniversary. Don't quote me on that, but I know that we're somewhere close on a major anniversary for it.
And so, Primitivo Garcia is one of the characters in your mural?
He is, yeah. And so I took great care in trying. That's part of the reason why I took it personal in regards to the termination of Native culture, because I really thought that I was doing my due diligence on researching as many different directions as I could. And then I also take care in doing different kinds of colors and designs to actually make the issue more about the people and what their actions were. I put Lucille Bluford in there. That's who the downtown library is named after. You know, she had been turned down with the University of Missouri 11 times trying to pursue her journalism degree, and eventually was given an honorary. But she did a lot for the African-American community here in Kansas City, and a lot of people don't know about her. And so I was happy when I put her up that I actually had people email me through Facebook and say, I had no idea who she was. And we have, you know, we have a building named after her downtown.
And so people have stood in front of this Love Kansas City sculpture and tried to decode it, like who's who and what's what?
I put small words up there next to the people because I'm already changing colors and I'm making them animals. And so I wanted to make sure that they understood who I was making my best efforts at with my silly cartoons to honor.
But like people have done their own research inspired by it.
Yes, from what I've been told, that people have dug a little deeper into parts of Kansas City history that they may have not known about.
When you started doing this research, what did you find out about Harry Truman and Native Americans?
Well, when I was at the wall and I was getting ready to fix it, to be honest, I was shaking. I was upset, and I was still taking it personal. And then once I put in the right question, I found that.
Do you know what that, do you remember what it was?
I just put in Harry Truman's relationship to Native American culture. And so what popped up was multiple articles about his policies on grabbing people from different reservations and assimilating them into urban cores. And so I don't know what his motive was. You know, I wasn't even alive. And there's two different perspectives on what he was making an effort to do. but what I do believe is that from spending some time up on the reservation is those people's cultural identity is extremely important to them. And it's well known that that's just not what they wanted for their culture, and they were being forced to do it. So they had some, I guess, calm for a while when FDR was in office. But as soon as Truman was in office, he systematically started grabbing people and relocating them.
Do you feel like, okay, I mean, I know that this is a rough way to learn a piece of local history, but do you feel like you had kind of a dialogue that opened your eyes to something you wouldn't have known otherwise? Or is this like, I really still wish this just hadn't happened?
It's a good thing. I mean, I think it's a good thing that it happened. I don't think it's a good thing that somebody took action on my stuff, but I feel strange saying that because my history started from writing on things.
What do you mean by that?
I used to go out and put my artwork in places where people may have not wanted it to be. And in fact, honestly, when I first started painting in Westport with gear, a lot of people didn't want us around there either. And they read all kinds of interesting stuff into the work that we were putting out there.
Well, okay, so I want to back up. You wake up one day to a call that someone has written some criticism and some sort of, criticism of your depiction of race. Mm-hmm. And this is after you have done what you think is due diligence and doing some research and trying to be inclusive in the characters on your wall. And you've said that you were shaking and that it felt personal. Can you talk to me more about that? What felt personal?
I think anybody that made their best effort to do something, I worked really hard at trying to make it as inclusive as possible and try to present a well-rounded, version of history, which was already difficult to research in the first place. At least it was for somebody like me who's not a historian. And so I took it personal because I did the best I could. I took it personal because when I do murals, I'm leaving a piece behind of me. And so it's hard to not, when people want to argue, sometimes they, have Twitter wars or, like a social media interactions or an email or something. And all my social media emails and stuff are on the wall. So I'm available. And I'm available to have that conversation. And so, the combination of having a lot of other things going on in my life and then dealing with this was frustrating. And then you couple that with there's been a lot of things across the country of people removing artwork and stuff. And some of it I'm in favor of. So, I was really torn.
Wait, what are you talking about? Confederate
yes.
statues?
Yeah. And so I was, I was happy to...
And it sounds like you're in favor of removing those.
I'm in favor of removing them from public view. And if they want to put them in like a museum specifically about that history, I'm still torn on taking artwork down. That's a minefield to start walking through. But to know that so many of them were made as an intimidation, I can say that I felt like I had been, for a minute, painted with the same brush. And I know my heart, but I can't stand next to the piece and explain that to everybody. So somebody maybe would have viewed it as, that was fresh in the news and it's still going on. I was happy to hear that, Stonewall Jackson's family wanted that stuff to be taken down. They were excited that these things were going to be removed, and they were embarrassed by some of the history and not in favor of it being made in the first place. But I just didn't want to be, I think part of being shaken about that was that I felt like I was painted for a second with the same brush of being accused of being insensitive when I was making my best effort.
It's interesting to me. I mean, I probably would respond personally. I mean, almost definitely. I think most people would respond personally to something that feels like criticism on their work. It's interesting to me, though, because I also wondered if the criticism was actually of the president who was depicted, and maybe not of you at all.
It could be. But, you know, like I have to stand by the fact that I'm reachable, and I've been really blessed with the fact that a lot of people do know my work, and people have access to me. And that conversation could have been started. I would have been happy. And I think most people, I hope, would be open to the education and say, hey, you may have not looked at it this way. I don't know. They don't know me. So maybe they thought that I would have instantly started arguing with them. Maybe they thought they had me figured out and pegged. But after reading that and contemplating on it for a minute, I went ahead and erased the depiction of Truman. It's not to say that I may not go back and put him on another side of the wall so that regardless, it's still part of Kansas City history. Putting them so close together was a mistake, not a purposeful mistake. So I put one of my bumblebees that I put in a lot of my murals, and I made him looking up at the Native American, and there's a bubble coming out of his mouth that says, I love you. And that's not only a message to the Native American culture, but to the people that went out of their way to write on my piece.
Well, we're going to be right back to this conversation. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And when we return, we'll hear about some of Scribe's past experiences navigating race in his art. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been talking to the artist Scribe, who has turned his youthful love of graffiti into a career. He now paints commissioned murals and works as the in-house artist for Children's Mercy Hospital. We were just discussing the response to his Love Kansas City mural on Southwest Boulevard. Recently, someone spray-painted over it with what appeared to be critiques of Scribe's portrayal of a Native American character, or perhaps the critique was really of President Truman and his treatment of Native Americans. It's hard to say because Scribe's critics haven't approached him directly, but he's still trying to understand as best he can. Hi, Scribe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I'm going to pause for a minute just to say you've confessed to me that you were nervous to come here and talk about this, and that you're actually still a little bit nervous talking about it. Can you explain that?
The country has been throwing a lot of stones against each other, and I witness a lot of it through social media and the news and stuff, and it just seems like we've been in times that we've been dividing each other a lot more than trying to figure out and step back and ask questions as to why people feel certain ways. It just seems like so many people work in absolutes and move forward without being sensitive to it. And so with all that,
maybe just asking someone a question.
Just asking a question, why do you feel that way? Educate me some more on the history. And where this has come from in your past. Sometimes it's an individual's past, and sometimes it's historical past that we haven't been privy to through our education system.
And so it sounds like you're a little bit afraid to be caught in some crossfire.
That's difficult to put yourself out there, and it was difficult for me to even start the mural, and that was why I worked so hard at trying to make sure. And what I felt like in the times where a lot of people were being left out, I was making the best effort I could to be as inclusive as possible and thoughtfully portray those characters in different ways. I do the same thing at Children's Mercy now. Part of the reason why I do everything in animals is actually to focus more on the story and the heart behind the person, because I feel like a lot of kids and people can identify with that more instead of being concerned about what the person's physical appearance is. I feel like I tell my stories better through animals.
Is that seems like when the characters are specific people and not general people, that's a little hard, though, because people know, they know what a historical character looked like, or
they do.
You know?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, all I can do is give it my best shot. I mean, I'm a halfway good illustrator. And
I will give you a little more credit than that.
Well, I mean, it's all perspective. But I mean, when I started the mural, I approached it. I wanted to put my style and my spin in something that I've been doing around Kansas City for 25 years now. So I wanted my flavor on there. I wanted there to be as diverse of a history as I could put in there. But then there was also a responsibility to put things in there that are icons to people that sometimes might be questionable to others, because I have to reach an audience of people that don't dig. And so things might make sense to them because they've seen the silhouette of the scout on a t-shirt, but maybe never visited the site because they don't want to go to Penn Valley Park, or they, so I mean, I put those images in there because for some people that's, those are icons that they know Kansas City of, but they don't even know why.
So of course, really appreciate that you worked so hard at it, and I'm sure a lot of other people do too. And we don't know what the criticism was, which we've addressed, but what if you did get something wrong? Wrong, and I put wrong in quotes because different people have different perspectives on these kinds of things, but what if there is a community out there that looks at this and sees something problematic with it, despite all of your best efforts? How, like, in a perfect world, how does that conversation go? And what's your responsibility there?
Oh, that's really tough. That's a tough question. I don't know when it is that you're supposed to be able to say that I've done my due diligence. And I'd rather be open about the fact that I don't know when the right time is. I think it may sound cheesy, but you just got to trust your heart to know why, what your motives are. But a lot of the characters that are on the mural, people can say that have had checkered past. I mean, Charlie Parker was an amazing musician, but then somebody else could say that he had trouble with addiction, and so I don't think he should be a hero. Pendergast is on there, and somebody could say that he helped people that were below the middle class and possibly bullied his way into hiring people and creating jobs. And then somebody else could say, like, he murdered and did a lot of things along the way. And it's just, there's like these two sides of this coin that made it difficult for me to even paint it, because I found myself asking why I was up there. Well, which side of the coin do I really?
Well, isn't including someone, does that mean you're honoring them, or does that mean you're saying they're part of the story that we recognize?
They're part of the story, whether we like it or not.
It's interesting, though. I mean, this question of no one is perfect on the social justice spectrum. And I mean, maybe that's a little too much of my own opinion there. I think the thing that we all want, people try.
Yeah, and we want everybody to feel included. And people do fall. Yeah, they do.
And so when people fall short, even though they've tried, I guess I'm really curious, like, how do you handle that?
I don't know. I think that was why I guess the way I'm handling it, like I said before, is that I tried to express that I love the people that did it. I love the fact, in fact, underneath the B, it says, keep standing up. And it's a dual message for people that are saying that they need to educate people on things that I may not know about. It's a nod to Standing Rock. That was about the best answer I could do without, emotionally throwing a fit about what it did to me.
You're trying to have your side of the conversation.
I am. And I'm trying to recognize the fact that there is, I have privilege that I struggle with, and so and there's a lot of people out there in this world that are hurting and continue to be hurt, and so it's my responsibility to step back and ask, why is this happening? But then also know and be comfortable with the fact that those aren't the motives of my heart.
You know, we've talked about the fact that the characters on your walls are often, I mean, most of the time, cartoon animals. And that is what makes you so perfect for doing art at a children's hospital. But it also means that people sometimes see human analogies even where you don't intend them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking particularly of an image you did for the buses a while back.
I was honored to be asked by the Metro to do a bunch of characters riding the bus, and they wanted to do bus wraps on the outside. And so I chose to do frogs specifically because they were green, and to stay away from doing any caricatures of any specific person or race. And so I did one of them with a sweatshirt and a backpack and his jeans. I did one where they had a briefcase, another one where they were reading, and it erupted into being accused that the frog that was in the sweatshirt and jeans was African American, and that we were saying that only African Americans could take the bus. And that was a shocker. It was equally as, I guess, damaging to my psyche in a way, to watch people on message boards for the Kansas City Star and some other boards that are out there accusing me of racism, but overlooking all the other ones that I did. And there were people in there that I felt like had common sense that said, I just want to point out that this is a frog, and doesn't represent anybody. And other people were saying things like, have you been to a college campus lately? They're all wearing jeans and sweatshirts. I think that this accusation may be more of a reflection of your concerns or your racism. And so we just kind of had to honestly ride that one out. And the people at the Metro were great and supportive of me. And once again, I had to say, well, I know what my motives were, because I was looking at them as male and female frogs, not any race. And I know what I was trying to do. And I know that there's no uniform for any of us of any color.
Things have such symbolic power to people, and mm-hmm. you can't always... It's really interesting. I mean, because they are frogs, but they're frogs doing people things and mm-hmm. wearing people clothes.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess as opposed to frog clothes, like obviously people clothes, but you know what I'm saying? And so these are objects from human life, and mm-hmm. people read human messages into them. But what's interesting to me is that you as the artist, there are going to be a thousand different ways that people could read anything, and mm-hmm. you could create some real paralysis for yourself
yeah.
if you tried to imagine each and every one of those. Have you started trying to imagine how people are going to read the things you include in your murals?
Yeah, I mean, I do it at the hospital every day. And I do it, I did it when I started the Love Kansas City mural. But I'm comfortable with the fact that I know my heart, and I think that a lot of the people that actually personally know me know what my heart is.
And you think that people are actually talking about you and your art, though? That's the other thing that I wonder. When you talk about what happened with the bus, the arguments that are happening online, in a way, do you have to sort of step aside and say, this argument isn't really about me? It's about it's a bigger conversation about race that people just haven't sorted out.
I think it's a combination of both. I think that sometimes when I read a lot of the comments online, when it happened with the bus and when it happened with this situation, I put it on Facebook asking for help to know if anybody had any information as to who or why, so I could start the conversation. And it opened a serious can of worms that I eventually had to delete because people started attacking each other. and some of them even attacked and some of them supported me. So sometimes people are direct, but I think kind of like stepping back as to like why this happened, I step back, I try my best to remove the emotional part of it and step back and go, are they attacking me? Or are they attacking their frustration towards a bigger thing? But I'm accessible. Just like my wall at the time was accessible for them to, but it's difficult not to. I don't think that anybody that would be confronted with those, the types of things that I read online specifically said about me, and having your wall touched would not take it personal in some way. The challenge is, and it's not a challenge for me, is to not let it affect me into becoming the person that they're assuming that I am.
What made you want to do a mural called Love Kansas City?
There's been a lot of stuff around Kansas City, like a recent great Kansas City Pride, a lot of great Kansas City growth. In my opinion, there's a lot of people getting pushed around because of the growth. And I've seen a lot of people making an effort to make money off of people's love for Kansas City, but I wanted to...
Can you explain what you mean by that?
A lot of merchandise that's being sold out there, and a lot of...
Like Kansas City Pride stuff?
Stuff, yeah. I don't want to be too specific because I don't want to seem like I'm calling any particular thing out. I know that there are people out there that are doing it for genuine reasons, and a lot of people that I feel like are competing with each other over, like, it's kind of like a cash grab as to like who can cash in on their Kansas City Pride. And it's kind of cool that it's actually reached that much of a fever that people want to do that. I just felt like when it was my time to go out there and do something, I'd been here for 25 years now. This is the longest I've ever lived any place. I've lived all over the world, and I've been the minority when I lived in Israel and different places around the world, and but now this is the place that I've lived long enough that I feel like I can call it home, and I've learned more about Kansas City. And so when I first moved here, I knew my place. Now I've been here long enough that I feel like I'm actually a part of Kansas City, or at least I hope people think I am.
It's your reluctance to call someone else out. I mean, I think I can understand where that comes from, but just as someone who... How do you think being criticized, like, how should that go? I mean, not that anyone's the authority on how that should go, but from the perspective of someone who's dealt with it a couple of times.
Oh, much more than this.
How would you like to see it go?
That's a good question. I don't know if I've been... I think all my best conversations have either been luckily being interviewed on the radio or one-on-one with people. So I don't know what the answer is. You know, sometimes when you see those public forums where people are weighing in on it, on stuff, they hide behind computer screens or fake names and stuff, and they use it as a way to actually stir the pot. I wish I had an answer.
Donald Ross, also known as Scribe, thank you so much for sharing this really vulnerable, really personal story about your public art.
Thank you for your time.
Scribe is the in-house artist for Children's Mercy Hospital, and he paints on walls and other surfaces all over town. Up next, we'll talk with someone who's collected more than 400 community cookbooks from Kansas from 1874 to the present. This is KCUR Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now, community cookbooks. You know, those often spiral-bound collections of recipes by ordinary people in a church or school community. They are treasure troves of information. They document a slice of daily life in a particular time and place, how people cook, what ingredients they use, what's important to them when they sit down with friends or family at mealtime. Our next guest knows all about that. She's got a collection of more than 400 community cookbooks, all from Kansas, dating back to the 19th century. Louise Hansen, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
How did you start collecting these things?
Well, I am a librarian, have been, and now retired. And I love to cook, love cookbooks. And it all started with one, and
as just most expanded. Collections do.
That's correct.
But what do you think it was that really hooked you about these things?
Well, I found early on that they are much more than about food. They are about what Kansas women thought about the home, about husbands, about their weight, about their religion, all kinds of other things that are just fascinating.
Give me an example of where you discovered some of these other parts of life in a cookbook.
Well, you can look closely if you have a high tolerance for tedium. You can look closely at the recipes and the recipe titles so that early on in Kansas cookbooks, a veal stew was just a veal stew. And as the decades went by, titles took on the form of decadent, sinful, corsetiers would be an adjective. In other words, if you eat this, you're going to have to pull your corset out. And so you can document different ways of thinking about food and about the self, actually.
Is there a recipe or entry in one of these cookbooks that felt really especially fascinating to you?
Many, many are fascinating for different reasons. Early on, it was common to use the whole animal when you cooked to make scrapple, for example. To make scrapple requires scraping out a pig's head and boiling it for hours, and then mixing it with cornmeal. And so scrapple was very common, especially in German communities in Kansas. But more recently, our recipes like ice cream made of oatmeal and Scotch whiskey, and that's quizzical.
Recently, how recent is the oatmeal Scotch whiskey ice cream?
Yeah, it's from a Congregational Church cookbook of about 8 years ago. So there is a lot.
This is like a current trend.
I doubt it. But it is very interesting. They're odd and they stick in my mind. These types of unusual recipes.
When I look at really old recipes, what I have some fun with, I guess, is just that the measurements are often not how we measure things now. And so you kind of have to use ratios or make some assumptions maybe about what is meant.
Well, I think there were generally accepted standards like a fistful, but it was not very accurate. Somebody in Dodge City told me that their grandmother measured dough saying that it called for a piece of dough the size of Aunt B's goiter. that was the way of measuring the dough. Well,
so this recipe is only understandable to fellow family members who know Aunt B.
I'm afraid that one would be, yes. Yes, that would be very idiosyncratic to that family.
This practice of communities creating community cookbooks is also sort of interesting in that right now the trend is sort of celebrity chefs or culinary experts handing their prized knowledge to the rest of us in the form of a book that we will pay for and that will make them money. And this is not the model of the community cookbook, but it is kind of the model of, like, the community cookbook is sort of like food blogs.
Well, the community cookbook is supposed to make money. It's supposed to make money for the cause you believe in, if it's your church, your organization. These are fundraising efforts, and they have been from the very, very beginning. The first one in Kansas dates from 1874 in Leavenworth, and it was meant to raise funds for the Kansas Home for the Friendless, and so that women supported that organization. And the history of community cookbooks is fundraising for organizations. That's what it's all about, not to make money for yourself.
So why people just want the recipes of their friends and neighbors? They just want those recipes, or they also want to support the cause?
Mainly, I think they do want to support the cause, but they end up sharing the lore, the food lore, of their communities. It's a fascinating study, and what comes out of it is knowledge about the food ways of Germans and Czechs and Swedes. And
talk to me about some of the differences you see between the different Kansas communities represented in your collection.
Well, I think in contemporary times, they are more homogeneous. They're more alike. But earlier on, they were very distinctive. In Ellis County, where there's large German settlement, they reflect food in the German tradition. Of course, Lindsborg and that area, where there is significant Scandinavian settlement, their food interests are strangely enough still Scandinavian. And that is interesting because Lindsborg is not a great place to have herring as one of your popular dishes, or cod, or even lingonberries, which require a cool climate to grow. But so strong is that hold of that ethnic heritage that they will throw convenience and away and go for the foods that were traditional in the countries that they came from.
Is there a dish that came up in a lot of these cookbooks or in a lot of recipes from a particular community that you had never heard of before and that really intrigued you?
Oh, many, many.
For example?
Well, recently I was reading a cookbook that came out of the Greek Orthodox community in Overland Park. And they make what is called church bread. I think it's called prosphoro. And it is bread that is imprinted with religious symbols on them while they are baking. And then it is used at a communion service. But it is baked by a member of the congregation with this imprint on the dough. That kind of thing is very fascinating to me.
Why?
Well, first of all, I'm interested. One of my side interests is food and remembering, food and memory, and the way you can remember what your religious tenets mean, what your faith tradition is by stamping it on the bread. And so I just think that's fascinating way. We are going to make sure that you don't forget what this bread means, because we're going to give you clues right on top of the bread.
The time span of your collection, going back to the 19th century and including, you just referenced an 8-year-old recipe. Can you tell me about, you've talked about different communities represented in the collection, but what about this span of time? Do you see things changing in ways, like, can you observe a change?
Oh, absolutely. The early cookbooks are very concerned with matters of frugality, so that the titles will be A Poor Man's Stew, or the ingredients will have the cost of the ingredient, as that's how much you should buy. In 1906 in Horton, Kansas, if you wanted to make liver salad, you would buy 6 cents worth of liver. And today you would never see anything, any ingredient by its cost.
Other changes that you've noticed? I mean, what is the equivalent of that later on? Do you see indulgence is the other side of the scale, or just people lose that awareness of cost isn't part of what's written into a recipe?
It definitely has waned, the interest in cost. It's not that people are not interested in it. Sometimes you'll see sections on budget meals and that kind of thing. So people are still interested in how much food preparation costs. But it is not as meticulously documented as it was. I think it does represent an affluent, a much more affluent general situation socially.
Are there other changes that you've noticed over time that you see being told to you through these cookbooks?
Yes, there are many references to moral conditions now, whether something is decadent or sinful early cookbooks didn't. Food was for eating, and the
not for saying what kind of a person you are.
Right. The moral conditions of living did not appear ever, and this is a really important, I think, because the idea of good food, bad food. Also, though, we are much more conscious of healthy food, and you do see that. And early on, I don't think that was a concern, and partially because the knowledge of what made for good nutrition wasn't commonly known. But now you see a lot more conscientious sensitivity to what is in food, although not all. I mean, it's still common to have gelatin salads made with five or six prepared ingredients that are all sugar-based. So it's not that we are nutritionally policing ourselves that closely, but you do see a more conscientious attention to it.
Do you, as a reader of cookbooks, I kind of enjoy the notes that people will write on their recipes or on someone else's recipe usually, kind of amending it or reminding themselves how they tweaked it. Have you found any fun notes?
Oh, very many. One of the fun ones that is from, I believe it's 1925, El Dorado cookbook, community cookbook, that has a recipe for no-fault pie crust. And woman who, Mrs. Chesney, her name was, who wrote the recipe, has written in the change in the ingredients amounts because she made a serious mistake when it was printed. And she has gone to apparently all of those cookbooks to change the ingredient. So the no-fault pie crust had a serious fault in it.
You are going to be the featured speaker tomorrow night at this event called Home on the Range. And I'm going to give some more information about that in a moment. But what intrigues me is that there is a potluck that's part of the event. And potlucks and community cookbooks seem like part of the same animal.
Well, yes. A lot of the recipes that might appear in a community cookbook appear at potlucks. So tomorrow night we'll take a look at that.
Potlucks, though, I mean, do you think that there's like an especially Midwestern potluck thing?
Not especially Midwestern, but we do like our casseroles.
Louise Hansen, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Louise, as I mentioned, will be the featured speaker tomorrow night at Home on the Range. That's at Shawneetown 1929, tomorrow at 7. A potluck is part of the event, so bring your best dish, maybe a casserole, if you plan to attend. And that's a wrap. You can listen back to anything you heard today at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have that ready for you later today. And you can talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, it's been a couple of years since high-profile news made the public aware of sexual assault and a climate of discrimination at the Missouri Capitol. So has anything changed? Plus, we want to hear how you feel about your safety in public spaces in light of mass shootings. Are you rethinking assumptions going on with life? Chime in tomorrow on Central Standard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date's next.